When you realize what your future can be, you want to do it right. UCF Online offers more than 100 fully online programs, plus personalized support from success coaches, so you can get to the future that's right for you.
From the University of Central Florida's Center for Distributed Learning
and the University of Louisville's Delphi Center for Teaching and Learning,
I am Tom Cavanaugh.
And I am Kelvin Thompson.
And you, dear listener, are listening to TopCast, the teaching online podcast. Welcome to the podcast, and hello, Kelvin.
Hello, Tom. Welcome to the podcast for you, too. I thought it was interesting. You said, you. I was like, is that a good you? Is that a bad you? I hope it's a good you.
It's a good you.
We like all our listeners, right? I mean, we like everybody. Right.
We like it to feel personal. It's a personal invitation to join us, you know. Pull up a chair, grab a cup of coffee. Let's talk online learning. Nothing more fun than that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's your cup of coffee. I have one,
there's
too.
My cup of coffee. Right.
I have my pink because this happens to be Valentine's week.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, we're recording in February, Valentine's Day week. Yes, indeed. Before we get into the coffee any further than we have, do you mind if I just slip a little plug in on the front end?
Plug away.
So just want to ask you, dear listeners, to please consider responding to a brief, oh so brief, one question. One, count them, one, uno, one question survey. It'll help us. It'll help us. Now, if you got a little time and you want to click a few responses to some other questions, that's fine. But all we're asking for is the one question. We're just trying to plan for the best season 10 that we can possibly make. And a reminder, we start our new season in May of 2024. That'll be starting our 10th year of this, season 10. So we want to make it the best as possible. So here comes a URL where you could go find that one question. It is bit.ly/topcastsurvey2024. bit.ly/topcastsurvey2024, lowercase, no spaces. We'd appreciate it. There's a link in the show notes as well. One question. That's all. Just one.
I hope you do it. We would love to have it.
So what's in that pink cup of coffee you got there?
This today is Tim Horton.
Tim Horton, eh?
It's a Tim Horton coffee, eh? And it's decaf, so it's just sort of like, I don't know, Tim Horton regular coffee, you know, Donut House coffee decaf for the afternoon. I've already had a lot of coffee this morning that was not decaf, so I sort of felt like if you didn't want crazy-eyed Tom for the podcast, I needed to tone it down a little.
People probably watch that. They'd probably click the YouTube link for crazy-eyed Tom Cavanaugh.
Yeah, they'd probably be like, what's wrong with that guy?
That's right. I was thinking of the tagline for your decaf Tim Hortons. What's that? All the Canada, but less intensity? I mean, I don't know. What is that? I don't know. I don't know. What is that? No, that's good. You probably want to know what I'm drinking. This is a single origin Papua New Guinea from Sunergus Coffee here in Louisville, Kentucky. And it comes, the coffee does, from a place called, and I'm sure I'll get this pronunciation wrong, the Nebelier Valley in Papua New Guinea, where there is a coffee mill that has been in operation for 40 years now. And interestingly, we're told that this coffee mill is staffed by Aboriginal workers from two different local tribes who have historically been in conflict. The mill and the work have brought literal common ground to them. So it's kind of these conflicted folks, they come around the coffee, they work together, it's good, they've got kind of good associations there, and they make the coffee, they send it out to me, and I'm drinking it here. So coffee's good. I always like a Papua New Guinea. I wonder if you can find some kind of connection to today's topic in my cup.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm thinking things that have been in conflict. There's probably a nugget in there. Would you say find common ground between things?
Yep.
There's probably a thread to pull on in that little hint that you left me.
Yeah, that's what I was shooting for. Mm-hmm. These common ground between two related but maybe opposing forces. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to tell people kind of what we're talking about today and where those possibly opposing forces might be?
Sure, yeah. We live in a world of tension and gray areas, don't we? Mm-hmm. So as we are recording this episode, it has been a couple of weeks since the U.S. Department of Education under the Biden administration has announced its intention to change the way, quote, inclusive access programs are carried out in U.S. colleges and universities, sometimes called first day access, but more commonly called inclusive access. Mm-hmm. So we thought that this might be a good time to kind of check in on how inclusive access fits in within higher ed, digital learning, and maybe not even necessarily digital learning. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's not digital, but using an LMS, mm-hmm. and what this intended change kind of might mean for the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the first time we've talked about these kinds of things. Quick plugs, we'll put links in the show notes, but there are at least four, maybe more, past episodes where we've touched on things like this. Episode 11, getting to the goal of going textbook free. 51, how can we make textbooks more affordable for students? 70, student access to digital materials during COVID and beyond. And 82, fostering large-scale OER adoption. And maybe I'll just go there real quick and say that sometimes, right, it's like when we're trying to do this good work for students with affordable access to instructional materials, sometimes it becomes a little bit of a family squabble. Folks who are motivated by that noble purpose kind of get a little feisty with each other, like, okay, well, it's really about open access or open educational resources or open, you know, low or no cost. Well, you can do greater good for a greater number if we work with publishers. And there's some tension.
It's religious wars.
Yeah.
As John mm-hmm. Opper used to say, our friend here in Florida, about LMS decisions and preferences. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are strong feelings on all sides when it comes to this, especially within like the OER community, where people feel really strongly about the ethos of open. And look, you and I are both been real big supporters of that. Yep. But there is sort of a reality that we live in that, to your point, I think we can probably combine strategies, not necessarily say everything has to be OER, do yeah. as much as you possibly can OER, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. recognize that there's a whole ecosystem of the publishing world that we're probably not going to disrupt. And what can we do to make it more affordable, more accessible for our students so that they can have the materials they need to be successful at the lowest cost possible? And, you know, inclusive access programs have been a solution for a lot of institutions to try to accomplish that or get as close to that as they possibly can. And mm-hmm. like, we're no different than any others. We call it first day access here, but it's mm-hmm. the same thing. It's a piece of our broader affordable instructional materials program.
Well, speaking of, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page as we proceed with the rest of this episode, you want to try a little micro primer on kind of what, why, and how for inclusive access broadly framed?
Yeah, so what? It's putting digital course materials into the hands of students at the start of a term. And they don't have to go buy it at the bookstore. They don't have to go to a site and put in a credit card number or through some e-commerce portal. It just shows up in your course. And then you get billed for that through your student account, just like you do for student fees or housing or tuition or anything else that students have to pay for. And it becomes eligible for financial aid or other kinds of sources of you know, that students use to pay for what they need to pay for at school. And so, you know, it provides a convenience for students. Mm-hmm. And in exchange for all of this sort of large-scale adoption that publishers get by providing kind of automated materials, there's a discount that's applied. Mm-hmm. So it should be cheaper for students. Mm-hmm. There are two models. There's an opt-in and an opt-out. 99% of the schools, that's not a real number, but it's probably close,
almost everybody
has an opt-out model, which means the students get the materials, but if they don't want to participate in it and have their account charged, they can click a button and opt out. And so maybe they want to, you know, go get it on their own, or maybe they've got a roommate who's got it, or some, there's a version of it that they don't want to, for whatever reason, they don't want to have the university bill them for it. We at UCF are actually one of the few schools that has an opt-in model, which means all of that is true, but within the first 5 days of class, basically, you know, before ad drop, the student has to click a button to say, I want to participate in this. Mm-hmm. And typically the adoption numbers are a little bit lower than they are for opt-out. Mm-hmm. I think we're somewhere around averaging 65%. I think opt-out is probably around 90%, something like that. So there's a little bit of a delta there. Mm-hmm. But the students have a lot more agency in deciding whether or not they want to be charged for it or not. Our students, we actually have a very vocal and opinionated group of students who have chosen this as a cause du jour. So it's one of the reasons why we have made the decision that we've had. But overall, I think either way, the goal is to get materials into students' hands in a discounted price, conveniently, in a way that can be easily paid for through their student account. Now, contrast this, one last term, which is equitable access. So you may have heard of inclusive access, which is what I just talked about, but there's equitable access. Inclusive access is implemented on a course-by-course level. So each course is going to cost what the book costs, or the courseware, if there's courseware associated with it, or some homework system or something that is often tagged in a package or something. So course X is going to be $50 and course Y is going to be $65, just because that's what the courses cost, the materials cost. Equitable access is that all students get all their books for one low price, and it's just baked into the fees that they pay as part of their tuition. And it's just like a $30 course materials fee you pay for every one of your courses, and then your books are just given to you, regardless of whether they're more or less in any particular course. It just sort of gets, you know, aggregated out in the total. So that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Just to say maybe one additional word about inclusive access. Here's how I think about it. I think there's two intertwined whys a little bit, right? And I think you spoke to both of them in a combined way. And when I worked down the hall from your office, I thought about it this way. There's both affordability kind of things, like lowering the functional price for students, and there's just making sure that students have access to their instructional materials right away. Right? So those are two related but distinct things. And when I was at UCF, we pursued both of those things through the work. Interestingly, some other institutions, I've seen it play out like as one thing or the other thing emphasized. You know, more as like, okay, we're just trying to get students direct access to this. And there's not so much this touting of the affordability kind of a thing, or it's an affordability thing, which then, but not so much the, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number, you know, kind of a thing. So just interesting. Now, the reason we're talking about this today is, and I was paying attention to other things, Tom, but you recently drew my attention to this. I had not been tracking it as closely as you, but just in January of 2024, just a couple of weeks ago, as we're recording this, the Department of Education's 2024 negotiated rulemaking agenda, surprise, proposes to eliminate provisions for inclusive access in that opt-out frame. And so we'll put stuff in the show notes, but there's lots you can read about this, and, you know, quotes from students and different angles, you know, edge case things and nuances and all. But that's the precipitating event that's got us talking again about this today.
Yeah, correct. And there's an awful lot of stuff in that negotiated rulemaking. So if you want to make your head explode, go look at that, because there's all kinds, especially things that affect us in the distance learning world. But it's not just constrained to us. But this is one that we thought we'd talk about today. Yeah, I've had several large publishers reach out to me and ask me about, you know, our support or advocacy. And it, honestly, it's been tough for me to kind of even, I mean, I'm happy to talk to them. They're good partners, mm-hmm. and we have a lot of students who buy their books. And so, yeah, you know, happy to have a conversation. But honestly, because we are opt-in, it's not like we, I don't think we can help them. In fact, UCF has been cited by name in several articles I've seen as an example of a school that, see, you don't need opt-out. I'm like, whoa, hey, we're just over here doing our thing. You know? Like, we didn't ask for that inclusion, but it's true. As I understand it, the concern that the department has around this has to do with student agency. So mm-hmm. do students have the ability to make the best decision for their own academic career and finances without having that imposed on them mm-hmm. by other parties, whether that's an mm-hmm. institution or a publisher or a bookstore or whatever mm-hmm. the case might be. And I remember in the conversations that I had with students here, when I was the subject of a email and other campaign advocating for us to remain opt-in. Mm-hmm. When I talked to those students, one of the things they said was, well, if the publishers are for it mm. and the bookstore is for it, then it can't be good for us. And I thought, well, that's a very cynical but interesting perspective. And their point was, all of the stuff you're saying that it reduces the cost and, to your point, what you said just a few minutes ago, in my mind, the affordability piece is a means to an end for student success, because we want to make sure that, students are not going to be successful in their course, presumably they don't have access to the book. Mm-hmm. And so if the book is too expensive or creates a burden for them, then we want to get it to them as cheaply as possible so they can get it, so they can succeed. We don't want to give them a book just to give them a book. There's a purpose for it. And so students got that, but they said, but let us make the decision about whether or not we want to be receive it through this program. And okay, I get it. Some of the articles I've read, there's actually a student at FSU that has been quoted a lot mm-hmm. Who's kind of made that same point. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. it's our mm-hmm. decision, we're grown-ups, mm-hmm. we can decide if we want to pay this money or not, or get it through some other means, or just choose to do the course without getting the book. That's our grown-up decision with the consequences that come from that. As a parent, I want them to succeed,
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. And just human behavior, right? Forget age and maturity and all that, and just think about just human behavior. Whether you're designing a survey or designing a user interface for a software program or whatever you're doing, make it easy for people to do the right thing. That's a principle.
Right. So, right. You know what they say about 401k programs or things that if it's just given to employees, there's a 90% adoption rate. But if you ask people to go sign up, it's below 50. And again, not real numbers, but
that's right.
The point is made.
That's right. So, so shall we say that if we don't know what's going to happen yet. This will play out over some months, this negotiated rulemaking thing. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But if this goes forward, UCF may be fine because you're already opt-in. But many institutions that have programs like these are going to have to rethink processes, procedures, and practices. Think that's fair to say?
I do, yeah. Because it was actually, we were late to the game, if you recall, because all of the infrastructure required to implement a first day access or an inclusive access program was all based on opt-out. Mm-hmm. And we were saying we can't do that. So we ended up having to get some sort of a custom thing that was eventually kind of mm-hmm. cobbled together for us. Mm-hmm. And maybe because that exists now, it might be easier for these schools mm-hmm. to go the other way, if this ends up in a changed law or regulation or whatever the result is. But it is going to have to force them to change their procedures, maybe how they communicate to students, what they are supposed to do the first week of class. And I, you know, it'd be interesting to, if that happens, to kind of track at a meta level student success, if that's impacted.
Right. That, I think that is an important point, right? That you can be so spun up on some of the particulars, the how, and I was at a, you know, the sort of the business consultant, self-help guru, John Maxwell. I was at a John Maxwell event once, and he was making a point about something else, but he used this idiom, this metaphor. He said, you know, he was talking about like career progression. He said, you can get to the top of the ladder only to find out that it's leaning against the wrong building, you know, and I think about that, about this, right? We could get all spun up about the how and then have missed the point entirely if we actually end up doing harm.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think for the, at least the people at the institutions that are advocating on both sides of this, you know, I want to give the department the benefit of the doubt that it's really about consumer protection.
Yeah.
And people at institutions that are in favor of opt out have student success in as their intent. Yeah. I'll make no comment about the bookstores and the and the publishers. To be fair, I think they all want students to succeed too, but they also are for-profit enterprises that need to make money.
That's right.
But you know, we'll see at the end of the day if it does make a difference.
Yeah. Do you think it's worth just kind of sitting there in that topic for a moment, like? What do you think really is the best way to ensure that at scale students have access to instructional materials right away in an affordable manner?
Yeah, well, I think that's another podcast, Kelvin. look, honestly, we operate at a pretty large scale. We have 70,000-ish students, and for a lot of reasons, we've chosen to opt in. I think if we didn't have such a push by a particular student advocacy group, we probably would have gone opt out just like everybody else, you know, because that was the default. But I think it's worked out okay. And I think our success numbers I don't necessarily have a lot of, you know, real data to. But my sense of it is that our success numbers are as good as anybody else's that has opt out, and maybe better in some cases. So in individual courses, our opt-in percentage is, I don't know, over 75% in certain courses. And so, you know, I think that if you manage it well and you communicate it well and you explain the value of it, students will do what students think is the best for them. But you can't just turn it on, fire, and forget and expect it to make a difference.
And I think that's a very good point, because I've gotten glimpses of that before at other institutions, and it does seem like there's a looking for an easy button or something and just kind of set it and forget it. And you made reference a little bit ago to the UCF Affordable Instructional Materials Initiative. We've talked about that in prior episodes. We'll link some of that in the show notes. But in a nutshell, you've got kind of a portfolio approach. There are a variety of things going on in service of making instructional materials available to students in an affordable way. I mean, you have a celebration event annually. You note the dollars saved for students. You celebrate many aspects of that. Do you want to try to briefly highlight, like, what we've talked about inclusive access, we've talked about OER, anything else you want to mention that goes into that pie?
Yeah, library source materials is a big piece of it. So OER, library source, and first day access. And then, you know, we do just encourage faculty through a statewide program that was started at FIU called Affordability Counts. You know, if materials are $20 per credit hour or less, they qualify for kind of special recognition. So between all of those different things, that's sort of the spectrum of affordable instructional materials. We did just have our AIM High event just a couple days ago. And I have the number handy. So just last year, through affordable instructional materials initiatives, we saved students collectively over $12 million in just 1 year. And so that ain't nothing.
Yeah, it's great. Operating at scale. I'll put in another plug. We said it before, but I'm pro OER, and you know that. I have personally pursued creating stuff that's Creative Commons licensed and made it freely available, and that's intricate, and it believe in all of that. And yet, I think that scaling sometimes can involve the realm of the publisher as well, right?
Yeah, you kind of have to deal with the infrastructure and the grooves that are already worn to kind of impact things that already exist. It's hard to build a whole new ecosystem, right? That's what OER is. And mm-hmm. we're big supporters, but taking every hill on the battlefield takes time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. As we maybe head toward the finish line, maybe we talk a moment about where we go from here kind of collectively as a group, our listeners and us. Any recommendations for what we should all be doing? Take a nap? I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
I would say pay attention to it, especially if you've got these first day access or inclusive access programs or equitable access at mm-hmm. your institution. I think you need to have your antenna up anyway. And you know, great resource is WCET. You know, Russ Poulin and his team, they do a great job of tracking these sorts of policy things. Jared Cummings at EDUCAUSE. Mm-hmm. I always listen to what Phil Hill writes or podcasts about. And I think, you know, you couldn't go wrong kind of getting their analysis. And mm-hmm. they'll save you an awful lot of reading of rules and notices, because they can kind of give you like, all right, here's what it says, here's what it means, here's our take on it. So it's mm-hmm. it's a little more than you just kind of reading a bunch of dry stuff and trying to make some sense out of it yourself.
Well, we'll curate some relevant recent links from all the groups that you just mentioned and any more that we find, and we'll stick them in the show notes. And that'd be a good jumping off point, listeners. If you're not already dialed into those sources, you could, you know, springboard off from there and pay attention. And I don't know, maybe we all, whether this kind of work sits in our shops or kind of across the quad with someone else, maybe just staying attuned to it and beginning to talk about what if we had to do this in some different manner, what would that take? And just beginning to raise the question a little bit is maybe not a bad idea.
Yeah, prepare yourself a little bit just in case. Phil Hill said in a recent podcast that he originally speculated that because it's an election year, that things would calm down in lieu of things that are maybe higher up on an election year kind of cycle, things like, I don't know, debt forgiveness or something like that, that would probably suck up more of the air in the higher ed conversation around election year politics. But he said, based on what he's seen lately, it seems like maybe if they feel in the Department of Education that there might be an administration change, that they're going to get as much done as they possibly can, that maybe it's going the other way. And it feels like there's a lot of activity right now, which I think for the people who are listening to this podcast means all the more that you should pay attention to what's going on, because mm-hmm. it could result in changes if that is the perspective of our friends in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Shall I try to put this plane on the ground and we get on with our day?
Sounds like a plan.
Perhaps by way of wrap up, we might say that part of our work in digital teaching and learning is making the educational experience better and more affordable for students. Digital access to affordable instructional materials is an important part of this work. How's that?
It is, yeah. It's such a key component for all of our students, regardless of modality. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed your Papua New Guinea coffee.
Yep.
I enjoyed my Canadian coffee. Until next time, for TopCast, I'm Tom.
I'm Kelvin.
See ya.